All right, rolling.
Hello and welcome to Reality Episode. Oh, shit.
All right, let's try that again.
Go.
You can't stop me from drinking. It ain't no use to try. You can't stop me from drinking. It ain't no use to try. Because the way you treat me, well, I'm gonna drink until I die.
When all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Man, I have like a cypherpunk hard on right now.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them. We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
What's up? This is Plato. I am your host for tonight's episode of Reality Exploit Roundtable, episode 11. Today's October 11th, 2012, and we've got a full panel for you tonight. We got Voodoo, Smuggler, Hero, and Wise Guy. How's it going, everybody?
Just fine.
Hey.
I feel like punking it up.
Smooth.
Alrighty. Let's kick it off with our first topic to Smuggler. Iran says that they're going to build their own internet because what we got now is just shitty. So, Washington Post reports that Iran is making an internal intranet, and they're going to exclude the rest of the world. Quote, the researchers who uncovered the foundations of the new Iranian network said they found that it already hosted a number of websites, typically government or academic sites, meaning that the beginning of an Iranian intranet is already in operation. Former Iranian parliament member Mousavi Kohaini says, the main reason for this project is security. They may say it's to increase internet speeds or protect against harmful content, but it's always been security. Former Deputy NSA Director Cedric Layton weighs in. He says that the project will improve Iran's network security skills and increase their capabilities to both launch and repel cyber attacks. He also says that any attempt by a country to make an internet is doomed to failure. Now, if I've learned anything at all in my years on the internet, it's that you cannot control data by fiat. Smuggler, you had a great line in the second round book on strategy where you said, what fences are to atoms, data privacy technology is to bits and bytes. So, if Iran secedes from the internet and forces all its citizens to participate in their own, what business models do you see evolving to subvert this?
Well, of course, the data traders and data blockade runners to do the upstream. And for downstream, it will be probably satellites just pumping down internet traffic. So I don't think that the Iranians will really lose all access to the internet, but it will be much more complicated and much more expensive to get online. But again, I mean, there are entrepreneurs out there that smuggle stuff today, and why not smuggle a few bits and bytes?
Do you think this is going to kind of force people to figure out interoperability and figure out how to hook together, you know, the outside internet and Iran's internet and the mesh nets and, you know, get those interconnects in place?
Yeah, absolutely. And there will be always places in Iran that have uplinks to the standard global internet, like hotels and government embassies of other countries and stuff like that. So there will be little bridgeheads where you can get through, and people will learn how to use them and how to sell access to the global internet on the black market. And I'm pretty certain they will do so. However, it means, as always, that the non-tech people and the people that obey every rule will be left out of the game.
What about the people who can't afford it? Could we end up with a caste system of the poor people who are stuck with the shitty internet and the government bureaucrats and the rich who can afford the external access to actually, you know, download torrents of the latest TV shows?
And porn?
Hey, there's no porn in Iran.
There's plenty of porn produced in Iran. Anyways, that's always the risk, and it will probably happen. But in parts, you can also see is that in the West happening right now, there are people that have real internet, like big upstream and downstream, while the poor people are just there to consume with a big downstream and almost no upstream.
Yeah, that's actually happening in Kansas City. If you Google Kansas City Digital Divide, Wired has an article pointing out that Google Fiber is coming to Kansas City, but Google didn't want to roll this out to every single neighborhood. They wanted to make sure that it was only going to neighborhoods that had high demand. So they had this deal where neighborhoods could get a bunch of signatures together on basically a petition, submit it to Google, and if they had enough signatures, then Google would roll out fiber to their neighborhood. But you had to pay to actually commit to this, and it wasn't too much. It was, I don't know, somewhere on the order of $10, $100. But one half of the city is traditionally like the poor, you know, the other side of the tracks, and they don't have computers. So they are not willing to put, like, you know, several days or like a week's wages towards this project. And there's a crazy map where you can see, like, this whole half of the city has no Google Fiber access. And the other half, you know, the rich, affluent half, it's totally full. So, yeah, I see your point that this sort of digital divide or caste system is already in existence.
Well, it with Iran, it's external also. SourceForge just decided that they were going to shut off Iran from being able to access SourceForge for code because they would be subject to export restrictions. Of course, everybody blew up about that, and they changed it to where they would allow each individual project owner to decide on their own whether or not to export it to Iran. But, you know, I don't think Western companies and Western providers, application providers, internet providers, are as sympathetic to everybody having access as they make it out to be.
Only if there's a good profit behind it.
And, of course, the blessing of a state.
You know, when I read this article, I saw something that we've been covering on some previous shows. What this is clean IT. Just as you have China, which is some supposed, you know, communist country, turning into some semi-capitalistic system, you have the United States supposed to be this bastion of freedom, turning totalitarian and socialistic. And then moving toward this clean IT system where they want to create an internet where there's like a couple of providers of content, and you know, everyone's you know, you have Facebook and your general applications, and everything's locked down, and everyone's responsible for everything. So Iran is creating their own clean IT system. There's no difference between the two systems, except the way that it's being presented. The West generally looks over there and says, "Oh, look, they're trying to lock down their internet and then control it and everything." But that's everything that's inside of clean IT. So if whenever we're talking about how people in Iran would be able to get around it, and to get around it, or to get higher speeds, or to get access for people coming in or coming out, the same questions would be the same questions we had in previous shows, which we said, sure, this can be done. But what was going to happen is that the majority of the people are going to be plugged into this system, and then you may have a subculture underground, but, you know, we'll take a look at North Korea right now. There's people there that have internet, but the general majority of the people are being fed, they're consuming what's given them, and they're using the access that's there, and they're all complete brainwashed sheeple if there was any example in the world of what a completely brainwashed culture is from a very extreme, extreme way. It's North Korea and their society.
So in order to take the red pill or the blue pill, you've got to have enough money to see how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Yeah, or you have to have enough people that actually have tasted enough freedom that they're going to fight for it. In North Korea, you basically have an entire society where it's like very few people have any concept of even reaching toward those things. Right now, Iran has quite a culture that has worshipped and consumed U.S. culture and technology
to hate it, by the way.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but
not all of them.
Oh, I disagree 100%. Iran is a very cosmopolitan country. I mean, it's agrarian, it's desert, it's everything. But in the cities, they're very cosmopolitan. I defy you to show a difference between downtown Manhattan and downtown Tehran.
I agree with that. All of the people that I've met from Iran tend to be quite knowledgeable, educated, and Western-leaning.
Okay, so that's a difference right there.
Yeah, and that's why they are not that big of a fans of U.S. culture, as long as it gets to my experience.
Well, when I say U.S. culture, I'm not necessarily talking about like pop culture, but this idea of I don't know how to define that without being too trying to like say that. Well, let's say, okay, having cell phones, SMSing each other, using the internet for communications worldwide, doing worldwide trade and stuff like that. There's quite a culture of people there that are locked into this, and they're already going to be.
Doubt about that. I mean, I was not criticizing Iranian culture here. I was criticizing U.S. culture here, but never mind. The interesting thing about the discussion about the Iranian internet is what happened to the line of all those internet freedom people that says censorship is treated by the internet as just another failure to be routed around?
Well, that I was thinking myself, by the time that this Iranian internet is operational, there may be nothing good on the outside internet anymore. Maybe clean IT passes, maybe some more of these crazy efforts to police it through regulation and, you know, state intervention. And by that point, maybe it's all turned to shit. We got to move on to the next paradigm of communication.
That's what I would say also. I think that the idea that the internet routes around, you know, failures and things like that, it's basically based on the assumption that you have access to the infrastructure. And the internet is extremely vulnerable to the current internet infrastructures that are mostly built and supplied either by governments or by large companies who have no interest really in opposing governments. So there needs to be an entirely new infrastructure for the internet, something parallel, something like existed before the internet, in fact. And have store and forward and various other technologies, at least for minimal SMS messaging, maybe simple voice. Maybe it doesn't support high-speed internet. Maybe it's only, you know, what we used to have with dial-up. But that would be more than enough for a lot of people to get their fill of internet activities.
Let me spread a meme here. FidoNet version 3.0 carried on by the SneakerNet.
Yes.
I'm in.
Very good.
If governments were so, if they only had some sort of vision, they could have seen what was going to happen with the internet. And at this point, we would have a complete choice between Internet A, where we would have a CompuServe email address, or Internet B, where we would have an AOL internet email address.
But isn't that true, actually, in fact, because most of the people only know like Google and Bing and Yahoo and maybe Facebook or vice versa? So, I mean, even Facebook is trying to make everyone believe that Facebook is the internet. And seriously speaking, I mean, how many people on this planet really use more than maybe 10 websites per day?
It's certainly getting crazy, and it's bound to get a lot crazier. Let's move on to our second topic. Both the second one and our third one deal with the state fucking up the free markets. And we'll start with cheese smuggling. After a 9-month investigation, the Niagara Regional Police Service in Canada, in association with the United States Department of Homeland Security and the Canada Border Services Agency, is proud to announce that they have busted three men who ran a cheese smuggling operation. They are charged with illegally importing $200,000 of mozzarella into Canada from the U.S. Both smugglers, Scott Heron and Casey Langland, were formerly cops in Ontario. Heron got suspended and Langland got fired during the investigation. And according to the police news release, of the $200,000 worth of cheese that was purchased and distributed, the smugglers made a profit of $165,000. Now, Voodoo, I don't think I could think of a clearer example of a state interfering with the market and hurting people who are trying to trade peacefully. So, let's see. Dairy regulations and import controls on U.S. products make Canadian cheese cost up to 3 times more than across the Niagara in the U.S. So, that's hurting anyone who eats cheese in Canada. And these guys were just trying to fulfill that niche in the market, serve the people who wanted cheese, and now they're facing unknown fines or jail time because they didn't pay their duty. So, why don't you retell the story in the second realm?
Well, in the second realm, you could almost consider these guys, the two smugglers here, former police officers, as double agents. But they were still on the job, you know, aggressing against peaceful people. So they were actually just profiteers. They're just plain black marketeers, and they don't have any sort of allegiance or they probably don't even know what the non-aggression principle is, so they would have no idea about that. But you're right. Here's a market niche that needed to be filled, and these guys were filling it. And it's completely a result of regulatory capture. It happens in every area that the government regulates. The people who are ostensibly being regulated end up setting the regulations because, you know, government bureaucrats don't know where to set these regulations. They have to ask the experts in the field, and the experts in the field want to set the regulations to whatever benefits them, so that the big guys can continue to keep doing their thing, and startups and small providers get hurt. So that's the essence of regulatory capture. It's not surprising. It's not just the dairy program in Canada. The dairy program in the United States is worse, arguably worse. You know, between raw milk sales, we've got the FDA actually raiding people at gunpoint and stealing their raw milk because, oh boy, everything's got to be pasteurized. And you've got dairies in Arizona, independent dairies in Arizona that aren't part of the milk cartel that are being raided and sanctioned because, oh my, you're providing your milk at 20 cents a gallon less. It's just amazing. And it's across all industries, not just food. It's energy. It's oil. It's vehicles. It's everything. And I don't know what they could expect, but in the second realm, we can carve out niches where we don't fall under those regulations, whether there be temporary autonomous zones where we can trade our raw milk and our cheese and under the dark of night. It's sad we have to do that, but I guess that's the world we live in.
So here's what I see happening in the first realm. I think Monsanto is going to genetically engineer some cows to put fluorine in the milk and to make sure that the milk is addictive to everybody who drinks it, so they have to drink more, but only the Monsanto kind. And then they'll you know use their patents to make sure that only Monsanto cows, Monsanto milk, are the monopoly. And eventually, just like the Federal Reserve, the government is going to grant Monsanto their own police powers to just do the arrests on their own. What do you guys think?
Well, the profits made by those smugglers actually speak for that theory. You know, I mean, those profits are close to what you profit from the drug sales, you know.
Well, it's not surprising that, you know, industries attempt to do this. You know, you have all these cartels and organizations that try to restrict competition. I think it was Alan Greenspan who said that regulations favor the regulated.
Sort of a parallel. There was one other story that was a little bit similar. Something like 600 barrels of maple syrup were stolen from a factory in Quebec and smuggled into the U.S. And the Federation of Quebec Maple Syrup Producers noticed that a lot of it was missing. And they went into all the distributors, the guys who were selling the maple syrup, and took it back. And they escorted these 600 barrels back up across the border in a convoy, a heavily guarded convoy, to bring it back to the strategic maple syrup stockpile. I mean, this is different because, you know, it's no longer peaceful trading. This was a theft, and it was property that was recovered by a police agency, which I really don't have a problem with, but it was just pretty entertaining to think of, you know, a swimming pool and a half full of maple syrup being stolen out of the strategic stockpile.
Actually, that makes some sense. If you smuggle cheese into Canada, you can take the maple syrup as payment and smuggle back to the U.S. That way you can escape many of the money laundering regulations.
No. Those money laundering regulations apply to syrup.
Darn.
And cheese.
Yeah, but what happens when you show up with the rounds of cheese to the pizza place that doesn't have any maple syrup? That just doesn't work, smuggler.
Cheese is money. Maple syrup is money. Bitcoins are apparently also money.
So's bread.
Just as some not-need-to-know information, but the Romans actually used cheese to pay their soldiers from time to time.
Hell, I'd take wages in cheese.
Well, salt was also used as a means of payment to soldiers, thus the term, not worth your salt.
Cheese is money is very good.
So if we see a future where money in all its forms, be it cheese, maple syrup, salt, or anything else, will be regulated by know your customer rules and money laundering checkpoints.
You know, we're joking about this, but this is totally doable with open transactions. I mean, you can define your own asset types in there, and you could totally say, hey, I'm a cheese manufacturer, and this certificate is worth one wheel of cheese. And you can digitally exchange that certificate. You can sell it for bitcoins. You can sell it for, I don't know, World of Warcraft gold or whatever. And that gets exchanged around until the guy who actually wants the cheese sends it back to you and comes and picks it up from your warehouse. So, you know, anything is money as long as there's two parties who are both assigning it value.
I can't wait for the day where I can pay my taxes that I don't pay with really bad cheese.
Limburger.
Oh, man. All right, let's...
You know,
it's
as silly as can possibly be. Export restrictions on cheese or import restrictions on cheese. But you know what? That's what the lobbies go for. They get these state actors to, you know, pay them enough to where they pass these stupid laws. This, hey, guess what? We have a thing called CAFTA, the Canadian-American Free Trade Agreement. What happened there? How come there's import restrictions on cheese if we have CAFTA in place? I don't understand that, or NAFTA. This is just completely silly. CAFTA is Central America. So NAFTA, we've got NAFTA in place. We should have free trade between. How come there's import restrictions? Right? Maybe this 1,500-page document was all about restrictions. Go figure.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's nuts. One of my favorite authors, Glenn Greenwald, had a recent column where he's pointing out just how damaging sanctions can be And I mean, I guess there's some difference between putting a sanction on Iran and saying you're not allowed to give food to Iran, and a simple tariff that says, you know, Canadians have to pay like three times as much for cheese. But these sanctions are super damaging, and they're killing like a lot of people who just can't afford to feed themselves because they can't get money in, they can't get money out, they can't get goods in, they can't get goods out.
And they're completely uneconomic. It doesn't matter what school of economics an economist comes from. An economist will tell you these tariffs, these import restrictions, these export restrictions, they are completely damaging all around. And, you know, unilateral getting rid of all of the tariffs, the quotas, the restrictions, helps your area, your economy, your local national economy. And that's across all economic schools. So the fact that these politicians and these bureaucrats still enforce these stupid regulations means that there's a lot of money flowing into their coffers, because there sure ain't no science behind it.
Oh, damn straight. In Greenwald's column, he quotes the managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine, Blake Hounsell, and this guy, it blew me away. This guy Blake is talking about these sanctions, and he says that he was beginning to wonder if limited airstrikes on Iran may actually be the more morally sound course of action, because just a couple thousand deaths, maybe you could avoid having the livelihoods of 75 million people destroyed by these sanctions. That's fucking nuts. These are the policy guys who are going on, you know, TV shows and providing their expert opinions, and they're the guys going to the congressman and saying, oh, yeah, you got to do this because it'll save American lives and make the world a better place. And I don't know, they're all just fucked in the head.
Well, one thing about the sanctions on a foreign country for political reasons is when you say, if you look at, you know, how these things work and they don't work and all this, how many people are innocent people would die and the like, and the leaders not being punished, is that this gets back to a conversation we've had recently with a few of you, where we talked about some of the core problems with socialist Marxist theory, and that is the idea of the collective. And whenever someone who says that they stand and believe in liberty and the individual and are against socialism and communism and collectivism, and then they go and they go and they start, you know, bombing places where there's, you know, so-called collateral damage and the like, and doing these type of sanctions on other countries, what they are practicing is collectivism, and that is through the application of collective punishment. And they feel that, well, if they don't like it, then they should overthrow their government.
Yeah, but at the same time, as soon as they start to overthrow their government, they call them outlaws. It's a domination technique, not sanctions are meant to dominate, not to actually enforce any sort of change or whatever they want to see. Whatever the stated goals of the sanctions are, they're complete bullshit. What they want is domination over the territory.
Sure, but at the bottom level, when you're talking about people on the streets, you go in the United States and you hear someone, should we do sanctions against Iran? And what they hear is, should we do sanctions against people who are ready to destroy Israel? There's this collectivist thought. Should we bomb them? Should we do this? And they think, yeah, them, when everybody in their homes is associated with what some guy with his finger on a weapon is going to do. That it's a whole collectivist thing, because it's what the Iranians are doing.
Yep, I'm with you. I'm tracking 100%. That it just sickens me that way. But the fact is, sanctions don't work. They never have worked. They won't work. There's a big deal going on right now that the Iranian rial has been devalued so much, and that's a result of the sanctions. And it's complete bullshit. Sanctions don't work that way. The math just doesn't work out.
Why is the rial devaluing?
That I don't know, because the Iranian Central Bank doesn't publish the statistics that we would need to know to monitor their monetary base. but they're saying, you know, chicken's gone up, you know, so many hundred percent, and they're saying that it's actually hyperinflation now, more than 50% inflation per month in Iran. And they keep citing the chicken, but there are no sanctions on chicken sales. So it just doesn't make sense.
Well, if they're talking about hyperinflation, that's different than someone just looking at the exchange rate and calling it an inflation in the statistics. I mean, are they actually talking about the money supply is doubling? I mean, that points specifically at a printing press. It doesn't point at directly at trade restrictions.
I agree. But they're looking at these sanctions, and the Cato Institute has been putting out these things. Oh, the sanctions are working. No. Look, you have to know better than this. That the fact that you put these sanctions on does not cause inflation, right? It's you can cause shortages of some goods. Chicken is not one of these goods, and yet they keep going back to the chicken. The Ministry of whatever in Iran just ordered the importers to import more chicken. So obviously there's no import restrictions on that or no sanctions against that. It doesn't make sense. You're right. It has to go back to the printing press.
I think we need someone from Iran to talk about this that is knowledgeable and is living in country.
Perhaps we can do that on a future show. For now, let's move on to our third topic. And that is ride shares. There's a bunch of these ride share apps that are out now where you can install it on your smartphone and say, hey, I'm at this street and I'm trying to get there. And they'll hook you up with a ride. And there's these three ride share apps, websites, Lyft, Sidecar, and Tic & Go. And they're under fire from government regulators. And of course, it's the same old shit, same as the cheese. These regulators are upset that people are managing to opt out of the state-regulated solutions. So Forbes reports, both Lyft and Sidecar enable people to find rides via a mobile app from regular citizens who have a car nearby and a mobile phone. Both are designed on a donation basis, so that riders give a suggested amount, but technically are not hiring a driver because there is no required fee. But regulators apparently don't agree. The California Public Utilities Commission has issued cease and desist letters to the ride-sharing startups. So this CPUC organization, they're in charge of regulating public, not public transit, but stuff like taxis and limos. And they say that these apps are regulatable. And Sidecar CEO Sunil Paul responds, "We don't do that. We don't operate a charter party carrier. It's not a transportation company. It's a communications platform." So he wrote, these apps are just designed to hook up the buyers with the sellers, and predictably the state is looking for their cut. So isn't the same stuff going to happen to our digital exchanges and our trading platforms? Our centralized services like GLBSE, are those ever going to be able to evade state thievery and violence?
Yeah, I think that this is a perfect example of centralized systems and decentralized, the difference between a completely centralized and then the whole gamut between there and fully decentralized. One quote here from Zimride. Oh, and by the way, when you started this off, you said there's three apps. Actually, these are three startups. It's not just some application that has that someone released on GitHub that people are hooking up with each other. It's actually these companies have other meat space brick and mortar type corporations first, and then they have these applications. And from what it looked like, all of them are taking a piece of the action, either through users signing up, and I'm not sure if they pay a fee or some give a voluntary amount and the service to pay the actual service. I recommend all listeners to go check out the article in the show notes because it's interesting, the different business models that these companies have. But the one company from Zimride said, "From the beginning, we carefully designed the service to be in full compliance with the law." And so what's interesting about that is that when they say that, they're not actually saying we have designed our service to be in full compliance with all taxi, limousine, and transportation service laws. They actually said to be in full compliance with the law. In other words, they carefully designed their service to be in a realm where no laws apply to them, because they're in compliance with the law, because they're not under any regulation because of how they're set up. So I think that's fascinating, because right now in the Bitcoin world, you can have a company which works as an escrow for doing trades between people, like MT Gox. And MT Gox could get shut down, prosecuted, anti-money laundering. If they're holding money on escrow, they're working as a money service exchange business. There's all these things that they can fall, these rules that they fall under. Now, on the other side, the far extreme side of that, we have the more somewhat fully decentralized system of the Bitcoin OTC system. Now, that system has a website and has a centralized web of trust type thing. But all transactions, it's basically the core of the service is just people putting out offers, other people seeing them and then contacting that party. So it's very similar to some of these ride systems, where it's an individual puts out a notice, like if you just posted something on Craigslist and then someone contacted you, and then you work out your deals in private. And then when you do that, you're doing an exchange between you and another person. So all of a sudden, you fall completely outside most laws that have to do with these type offering this service as a company or an in between. So I think it's fascinating that these guys are not. They're centralized in terms of having a company. I think that their future might actually be something like the future of a new type of GLBSC or MT Gox system that end with, you know, open transactions and the like, where it's actually more distributed, where if you sign up for like Tick and Go, you may just be broadcasting out your bids and your asks for particular assets. Would be the same thing for like, I need a ride or I'm willing to give a ride. And then someone else out there actually seeing that and then negotiating that inside of an application between another person. And then the actual settlement happens with like a Bitcoin payment happen individually between the two people. So it's just basically like friends like giving each other rides. One thing we should throw in the show notes is that I think last year, the year before, there was a huge controversy about this type of a thing happening in Russia with taxis and people needing extra money, and everybody was turning into a taxi. So people would just sit on the side of the road and make a sign that they needed a ride, and other people would stop and pull over and give them a ride. And the government was cracking down on it really hard, because the pirate taxi business was just taking a huge chunk out of the regular business, and the government wasn't getting all their licensing fees and everything. It's very much related to this in a type of a pure P2P type system to like skirt the centralized laws.
And of course, the taxi owners and the taxi companies are the ones who can afford and really care about buying the lobbying agencies to actually, you know, buy off the politicians to convince them that it really is necessary to have this medallion system, because otherwise you're just going to have crazy people who are driving into walls and shit.
Yeah, by the way, one last thing I'd have to add is that I think that's exactly who's behind this. I don't think that who's behind this is necessarily like some government bureaucrat that's sitting down there trying to make sure that everything's done by the letter of the law. I think that as soon as these other transportation things, which are usually very heavily influenced with their own unions and stuff like that, when they started seeing this stuff, I think that they're the ones that are going to like push hard for very serious crackdown, even new legislation if they can.
Hero, I think that your mentioning of GLBSE is significant, as in light of what's happened to GLBSE in the last week. And I think also think that that experience of GLBSE and its trying to hew to regulation indicates why you do not want to operate any kind of venture out of Silicon Valley or inside the United States are openly non-distributed, where the board and all of the people who are involved in the company are publicly known, when you're, you know, vying against these very powerful government interests and guilds who are trying to, you know, press for seeking rents, especially when they have the government behind them.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good...
It's not just about distribution or centralization, but it's really about if there's a place where they can get you and, you know, do bad things to you. So yes, it's about going darknet, you know, going underground. And there's no reason why those apps couldn't have been issued and distributed by some anonymous entity somewhere and still make a cut.
You know, I don't even think this is a case where that needs to happen. These folks are unfortunately getting caught up in the furor over Uber. Okay, if you're not familiar with Uber, what it is it's an application where you can say, all right, I'm at such and such an address and I need to go to such and such an address, and you get a private car or a limousine to do that. And the taxi commission has been having a complete hissy fit over that. And so now they're doing this with these rideshare apps. They're getting caught under that same umbrella, any application that pops up like that. Well, these rideshare apps, these are not things that the taxis would be picking up, even if, you know, if this didn't exist. These aren't rides for these taxis. They're just getting caught in the umbrella. These are bureaucrats pushing this, not the taxis, not the taxi owners. Because this same bureaucracy were the ones that, when I was working in California, were mandating that we had to increase our carpooling and bus pooling or van pooling ridership every year. It had to increase. Well, these are prime applications to get that done, but they saw Uber and now they're focused on that, and so they see these and boom, oh, here's something else we can push our damn bureaucratic noses into.
Well, one thing's for sure, any of the people who are actually providing the rides need to be concerned that the databases behind these services don't expose them to risks. Every insurance policy I'm aware of in the United States specifically prohibits the use of the car in a ride for hire situation. So if the person should be providing this kind of service and have an accident, oh, woe be unto them. And having the database rat them out, that would be the end game for these people in court.
Well, even beyond that, you're eventually going to have the cars ratting them out, because by 2013, new cars are mandated to have black box data recorders that, in the event of a crash, they keep track of, you know, what speed were they going at, where did the impact happen, what was the timestamp. And, you know, eventually that's all just going to be hooked into the car's computer system, and it's going to upload it automatically directly to the police and your insurance company, of course. And the other thing is that this is another market niche. If insurance companies today are not willing to insure these drivers, somebody should start their own insurance company that does insure these drivers. And, I mean, hey, why not use the black boxes so you can have good data and see who's a safe driver and who's not, and use a reputation system and figure out your premiums and make some money?
Well, getting an insurance company licensed in a state is a major undertaking. So something like that would have to probably operate illegally and offshore. And then you'd have the situations of how do you do the estimating and the claim adjustment procedure, which is pretty complex.
I don't think you can understate what the point Wise Guy's making here is the liability that these companies that provide in these applications, these startups, the liability that they are assuming, that they don't even know that they're assuming, is incredible. I mean, especially in California, what a litigious state. But, you know, the fact that if you have any involvement in a transaction whatsoever, even if you're not, you end up ultimately not being part of the transaction, you just bid on the transaction, you're opening yourself up to liability with every transaction. And just opening up an insurance company is not that easy, although a black market insurance company would do a hell of a business in California, I think.
How about in healthcare? Oh my God.
Just one little note here. The Zimride, same guy, people from Zimride, said that after they, you know, well, full compliance with the law, says, additionally, we've gone above and beyond current requirements by offering a first-of-its-kind $1 million excess liability insurance policy to give both drivers and passengers peace of mind. So some people are thinking about that. But I think that there's some other similar systems that are happening around the world where people are... they're pooling ownership inside of a car and other vehicles. I think there still is a lot of other type of business model things that could, like friend-to-friend type things where people are putting in, I've seen this, where people put in their schedules and then they actually have a scheduling application for a car and where it's going and what it's doing, and people pay a certain amount of money for a certain number of hours in the car, and I don't know. There's a lot of creative stuff that can be done, still within small groups of people, without going to a full-blast free-for-all advertising and taking the ride system.
Shares work. Used to deal with airplane shares a lot, and I've seen shares like that turn best friends into mortal enemies. When you leave the vehicle, was there a paper cup in there? Oh man, that'll start a fight all day long. Was the gas tank on full or just under full, or maybe just, you know, right on the edge? You know, those things will kill partnerships in a heartbeat unless you have everything in black and white. This is the way it's going to be, and a system of fines within the partnership to say, you leave a Kit Kat wrapper on the floor, it costs $50 or something like that.
Well, I guess this is a little bit more difficult than just starting a black market insurance company. But I'm sure that, you know, given some time, we'll see solutions evolve. Let's move on to our fourth and final topic, and that's some high-frequency trading shenanigans. CNBC reports that a single mysterious computer program placed orders and then subsequently canceled them so much that it made up 4% of all quote traffic in the U.S. stock market last week. And the scariest part is that the single program's millions of quotes accounted for 10% of the bandwidth that is allowed for trading on any given day. I guess the guys who perform high-frequency trading have their own set of rules that says, you know, how many trades can you do. But it's apparently just a pool, and this one guy took up 10% of the pool for that day. So regulators are trying to see how they can rein in the practice of high-frequency trading, which accounts for 70% of trading each day, without slowing down progress and profits for Wall Street and the U.S. exchanges. So I got what seems to me to be a pretty obvious solution. Why don't we just split it into more than one exchange? You got the old school traders who don't want to deal with these bots. They just want, you know, to set their own prices and set their own bids and asks. So let them agree on their own rulescape. They can come up with a set of rules that says, you know, there's a cost of 1 penny per quote or something like that. And that'll screw over a lot of these high-frequency trading algorithms because they rely on getting a lot of quotes. And they actually even they're kind of aggressing against each other by DDoSing the markets. The idea is that if you can get your colocation server in, you know, right under the stock exchange, then your quotes go a little bit faster than everybody else. And if you spam them enough, you're going to delay everyone else's quotes, and you can take advantage of that latency to get some arbitration going. And, you know, there's people who aren't using HFT, and they might not like this because it really screws up the prices on the markets. So just let the guys who don't want HFT make their own rule set, and the guys who do want HFT, they can make their own other rule set and trade on a totally separate exchange. And am I just overthinking this? Like, wise guy, is government regulation really the way to go to keep traders honest?
Well, it certainly hasn't seemed that way. As long as the government is essentially owned by Wall Street, there is really no hope for regulation ever working. They get to write the rules, their lobbyists influence Congress in every way you can imagine. And one has only to look at what's been going on for the last, 30 to 50 years, and it's clear that they've been running the show. As for having two trading, arrangements, two types of exchanges running on the same stocks, I think that would be a very difficult thing to do if they're running at the same times of day. However, if you force the people who are doing the high-speed trading to be only after-hours people, and the main people get to trade during the regular business hours, that could actually work. Because otherwise you'd have this fight over, what exchange pricing is the one that's to be believed and relied on by the marketplaces. So that's the way I would see that type of thing working.
Wouldn't the quants with their algorithms just believe that the price was A, and the guys who think the quants are frauds believe that the price was B?
Yeah, but then when you're trading stock, if you go to sell your stock in one exchange or another, you'd have arbitrage going on between the different exchanges. I think it could get pretty ugly, but hey, maybe it'll introduce some interesting situations. Now, this high-speed trading is not anything new. For at least the last 5 to 10 years, front-running of people's trades by their own, brokerage systems has been known and even punished. I think Goldman Sachs, without admitting guilt, like they usually say to the SEC, tried to rein in some of its practices, the most egregious ones, a few years back. These high-speed trades in which you see bursts of trades going in and out of the market, some without ever initiating a trade, just an offer, they're there because what they're trying to do is either DDoSing, as you've mentioned, or they're doing price probing, where they're trying to see whether or not they can move the market in a certain way, or see where people have set their stops and various other considerations in the algorithms of the traders that are, their correspondents on the marketplaces.
Well, the sick part of this is that everybody's got to be conscious of the high frequency trading that's going on and the games that they're playing, and the fact that, like you say, they're doing a denial of service attack on the exchange to try and get arbitrage on there. Everyone who holds dollar denominated assets has to be conscious of this and outraged by it. Because of the way the Federal Reserve System is set up, it forces you to be in that market in order to just maintain the value of the dollars that you have. Not make a profit, just to maintain the value of the dollars you have. You can't stick the dollars under your mattress, obviously, and just look at food prices lately or fuel, my God. And you can't stick the dollars under your mattress and maintain that value. You have to be in that market. And here is pure, unadulterated proof that they're manipulating this market, denial of service on this market to manipulate this market. And everybody, in your grandma and you and everybody, has to be in this market in order to just maintain the value of their dollars. And it's a complete scam.
Well, I don't think that's true. I and a lot of other people have been holding gold either physically or trading it electronically, either on the regulated or unregulated exchanges. And we've done quite well.
Yeah, but that ain't dollars.
No.
Fudo said dollar-denominated assets.
Well, yes, that's why you hedge things with non-denominated.
Damn straight.
Yeah, and so what do they do? Gold is downplayed at every turn. If you turn on CNBC tomorrow morning, I guarantee you they're going to have some sort of person sitting there saying, "Oh, anybody buying gold's a crank right now, man," because they want you in this system. The idea is you have to be invested. You have to invest in the gold. You can't just keep it under your mattress. You can't hold dollars in your wallet and say that I'm going to be able to buy the same amount of milk as I bought yesterday. You can't do that. They're forcing grandma and her retirement nest egg that Grandpa spent his entire lifetime working at Link Belt Speeder or wherever he was into this market. And meanwhile, they are playing these games with these computer games with the market, and it's sickening to me the fact that this is the way the entire financial system is set up, and everybody acts like you're a crank as soon as you point that out.
Well, I'm actually not too sure who is really damaged by high frequency trading. I mean, to me, it seems like quite a few day traders that are not acting on base data for stocks, but just by, you know, hearsay and weather and whatever, they don't have their own high frequency trading computers, and they are losing out to the HFT crowd. So I kind of think that it's the day traders that are really the ones that lose to the HFT and that really complain about it. While when the fundamentals don't change, I don't see why a long-term investor makes any loss here.
Unless the market crashes, you're right.
The money being invested in the HFT is not client funds. Client funds are being used just in the internal books. The money that's actually being traded over HFT is the bank's own money.
Unless you're John Corzine.
Isn't that now prohibited by a lot of the new regulations that have come into play?
I don't quote me on this, but I mean the idea that the bank is playing with client funds, so if you call to a bank and you or they call you in most cases and you make a trade, that's obviously not going to be on the HFT on a millisecond trade. That's got to be bank money. That can't be client money. Unless they're calling you every few milliseconds.
Damn, that's why the phone's ringing so much.
By the way, if you want a movie that makes you sympathetic to the traders as the market crashed, watch A Margin Call with Kevin Spacey. It's a good movie. It makes you sympathetic to them as they're trying to unwind all these mortgage-backed securities in one day and ruin the entire market. It's a great movie.
And if you just want some general info on the ridiculousness that is the global financial marketplace, I gotta recommend Matt Taibbi's book Griftopia, where he covers the crash of 2008 and the ridiculous shit that Goldman Sachs gets themselves into, and it's a good read.
Yeah, I've got that.
Yeah, it's good. Let's call it an episode. I think this was a great show, and look forward to doing some more. Let's see, how about some plugs? Smuggler, is shadowlife.cc live yet?
No, it will be live end of October, because right now we're really busy at Libertopia in San Diego.
Nice. What's Libertopia?
Libertopia is a big conference, meeting, get-together, whatever thing of mostly anarchist and freedom-loving folks. And I'm really enjoying it, or looking forward to it, because it starts tomorrow afternoon. And I can't wait to see all the cool people and hear quite a few really cool talks.
Fantastic. Have fun.
Thank you.
Voodoo is operating Black and Yellow Pages, which is a, as it says, it's Yellow Pages for agorists. If you got a service and you want to sell it to others in the, you know, agorist liberty community, hit up Voodoo and get registered. And you can go on there and search and see what services are available in your area. Myself, Plato, you can find me on Twitter, Reddit, GitHub as The Real Plato. Hero operates agoristradio.com and .bit. And big thanks to Hero for continuing to host Reality Exploit Roundtable. Check out his other shows too, Coinbase. Hero and I do. That's all about Bitcoins. And also check out Cypherpunked, which is a great collection of interviews with all kinds of crypto-anarchy types, with a lot of really neat projects in there. Wise guy, you got anything to plug?
Nothing I'd mention.
Oh, there's got to be something. What's your favorite website?
Well, I look at globaleconomicanalysis.blogspot.com by Mish. He certainly seems to have his finger on the more mainstream analysis that's going on in the world of finance and government.
Nice. Yeah, I see links to Mish every now and then from Tyler Cohen's Marginal Revolution, as well as Zero Hedge. Sweet. I guess that'll wrap it up. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And again, this has been Reality Exploit Roundtable, episode 11.